All right, welcome to everybody at the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have two cases on our 10:30 docket. We will hear both of those one after the other. Y'all have all checked in. Justice Kerr is to my left and Justice Gabriel to my right, and I'm Chief Justice Livingston. I'll call the first case, Mullins v. Mullins, 216-449 CV, and Ms. Palmer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning, Justice. I know you've had an opportunity to review the briefs, but let me go through some of the procedural matters as they're important to the order that was ultimately entered in this. This matter was a dissolution of marriage. Ultimately, it was decided by a default judgment that was entered pursuant to a death penalty sanction ordered by Judge Jenkins in the county court out in Parker County. Just by way of dates, the respondent in this matter filed a motion for enforcement by contempt on August 15th, and that was set for September 29th. He then subsequently filed on August 23rd his second motion for sanctions against my client in this matter, and that matter was set for September 16th. At the September 16th hearing, attorney for respondent requested a death penalty sanction in this matter. He requested that my client's pleadings all be struck, and then after that was granted, he then scheduled a default hearing on September 22nd. Now, prior to that date, the court had issued a trial setting date for December 6th and 7th in this matter. Basically, our position is this. One, that the trial court erred in granting the death penalty sanction and that the record does not support that sanction. Specifically, there were no findings made by the trial court in relation to what prior sanctions could have been ordered or were ordered that would have forced compliance by my client. Counsel for the respondent simply made a series of statements to the court, and the court indicated ultimately that he was inclined to grant the sanction.
Excuse me, counsel. Isn't it true that on July the 20th, your client signed an agreed order whereby she had agreed to produce certain documents about a month later?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. My client entered an agreed order on the original motion to compel for the production of documents. My client produced those documents to her attorney, and even according to counsel's statement before the court, documents were produced to him in the form of a binder. He did indicate that those documents were not Bates labeled. One of the recurring themes that you'll find within our brief is that my client's attorney did not attend the hearing for sanctions. She did not notify my client about the second hearing for sanctions. She did not attend the hearing on the default judgment, nor was my client notified of the default judgment. Now, while it is true that you can impute notice of a hearing from counsel to a client, for purposes of granting a death penalty sanction, the court is required to allocate some level of blame between the party and the attorney. In other words, the case law is clear that you cannot punish a party for a sanctionable conduct that is done by the attorney representing the party.
But as I recall, sorry for interrupting again.
Yeah, no problem.
When your client was deposed, though, there were a lot of questions, as I recall, that she just flat out refused to answer. So, I mean, are you saying that she's entirely blameless in the discovery problems?
I am, Your Honor, and here's why. At the same time that the dissolution case was pending, respondent was pursuing a forgery claim against my client. Now, if you read, we didn't attach it, but I don't believe that the entire transcript has been attached. But in the transcript, it is apparent that she is attempting to assert the Fifth Amendment privilege. The representation in relation to that deposition seems to mirror the representation throughout this entire case. She's not answering questions that could incriminate her on the pending forgery case. So I don't believe it was her intent to defy the court. I believe she was improperly instructed in relation as to how to assert her Fifth Amendment privilege in this matter. Back to the hearing on sanctions and the order in relation to that hearing. The case law is very clear that the court has to make definitive findings in relation to what sanctions were made prior to the entry of a death penalty sanction that failed to produce the requisite conduct by the underlying client. So in this case, no such findings were made. Additionally, the order that was entered indicated that both the client and her attorney appeared. They clearly did not, according to the transcript. Also, there's no indication that evidence was ever presented in relation to notice provided to them. But more importantly, there's no findings made by the court. And understand, Justices, that the order submitted was drafted by opposing counsel. And he is an incredible attorney, and as is indicated by the procedural effort made here in this case. But you have to make specific findings within the parameters of the order that indicate the sanctions that have been attempted before. And you can't just say something as simple as other sanctions were attempted. Death penalty sanction is an extreme sanction, and for that purpose, there are procedural requirements that have to be met.
Was there a motion for findings of fact and conclusions of law?
There was not, Your Honor. There was not. Secondarily, even if the court were to find that the death penalty sanction was appropriate in this matter, my client did have an appearance on file, even provided that all of her pleadings were struck. The court had previously issued a trial setting notice, and while the court can change the setting notice to a later date with sufficient notice, the appearance in and of itself is sufficient to require the 245 notices. Now, counsel for the respondent here on the appeal has decided the Allwright case for the proposition that you can enter a default judgment on an appearance without notice. The Allwright case deals with a 122 motion to quash and the requirements under the rule that you then subsequently file an answer within 20 days. And under Allwright, it dealt specifically with a conditional answer filed simultaneously with a motion to quash. So that case would not be applicable to the case before the court today, which is a straight-up appearance 45-day notice letter, and then an attempt to end-run that notice by entering what is essentially or requiring what is essentially a no-answer default requirement when, in fact, there was an appearance of record on record with the court, regardless of whether her pleadings were struck. Finally, is our...
One question.
Yes, ma'am.
Was there any notice given at the hearing that she did attend as to these future dates?
As to the dates for the motion for sanctions, no. That notice was provided by the court at a later date. I presume you're talking about the original motion to compel hearing where she was in attendance. Yes, that's correct. No, ma'am. It was filed at a later date.
And then there's a change in the... hearing date for the final judgment.
Yes, ma'am. So what happens is counsel goes in on the motion for sanctions. My client's attorney does not appear, does not notify her of the hearing. Nobody shows. He enters a death penalty sanction, strikes all of her pleadings. At the time period of entering that sanction, there is a December 6th and 7th trial setting on record. Counsel that day goes and sets the matter for default on the 22nd. Now, just to be upfront with the court's clerk states, and it's indicated in the opposing brief, that he sent an email to her counsel notifying her of that setting. And I believe, and I'm sure Mr. Wentz will correct me if I'm wrong, that there was also either a call made from her counsel or an email indicating that she could not be there for the hearing. But regardless, the client, had no notice, and her counsel, if that's true, it's even more apparent that it was her counsel's responsibility, because if counsel had noticed, didn't notify her client, and then did not show when it was stated she would not be granted a continuance, that fault cannot be attributed to my client.
Well, didn't her counsel even file a motion for continuance?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Okay.
Regardless, our final argument goes in relation to the judgment that was entered. I think the case law is very clear that you can either choose a disproportionate division of the marital estate, or you can choose damages in tort for the case. And in the transcript of the default judgment hearing, counsel even represents that he will be presenting both sides but making an election of remedy. But then we received a judgment for the entire 100% of the marital estate, plus additional attorney's fees, plus $150,000 in exemplary damages. And as this court is well aware, you have to choose one or the other. They've never chosen, but more importantly, you have to have something to append an exemplary damage to. There's no exemplary damage for a division of the marital estate. They would have had to make the election to take the tort claim and then append the exemplary damages to that claim. So we believe essentially they've received a double recovery.
But their argument is that that's not a double recovery because it's exemplary damage is not compensatory damage.
I understand, but I believe that you can only receive exemplary damages as a result of a statutory allowance. The statutory allowance for those damages would have occurred within the parameters of the tort claim. They have, in accepting 100% of the marital estate, refused, essentially, based upon the case law, the tort claim. They cannot then append exemplary damages to their tort claim. So we believe that in and of itself constituted reversible error. But regardless, Your Honors, our main position in this matter is that the entire procedure was affected to essentially deprive my client of due process. Counsel was aware that her counsel was not responding. Counsel was aware that he had been contacted and told she would not attend. All of this fault, and I am never one to allocate blame to an attorney because I have been in difficult situations and had to face that sort of claim before. But in the case before the court today, my client had, as you'll notice from her affidavit, she had no notice that a judgment had been entered against her until she was going down for an appointment prior to the September 29th hearing, which was supposed to be on the original motion for contempt, enforcement by contempt. Even at that time, she was not instructed that a default had been entered against her. She didn't find out until she and her father went down to try to find when the next trial setting was. So I do believe that based upon the behavior of counsel in this matter, but more importantly, based upon the requirements, the case law requirements as mandated by the Texas Supreme Court in relation to death penalty sanctions, the court failed to make the appropriate findings, and having failed to do so, had no authority upon which to base the complete striking of my client's pleadings in this matter. And I'll take any questions that you have.
Yeah, I have one follow-up, please. So what is the specific remedy you believe your client is entitled to?
I believe my client is entitled to have the judgment and the sanction motion set aside and have the case remanded, Your Honor.
For a new trial?
Yes, ma'am. One final thing. There's also been a statement in relation to our failure to present a meritorious defense on Craddock. Because we're challenging the first element of Craddock, it's not necessary for us to present a meritorious defense, but that would only go to the abuse of discretion on the new trial. I still believe that the granting of the death penalty sanctions without the appropriate findings is sufficient for reversal in this matter. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Palmer. Mr. Windsor.
May it please the court. I think as I said at the beginning of my brief, this is a messy end to a 12-year marriage that the last few years were messy also. So there's at least some consistency there in how to deal with it. I'll talk about the damages issue first. Ms. Palmer said that Mr. Mullins was awarded 100% of the marital estate. That might be correct in what the judgment recites. However, the facts of the case are that this was not your average prove-up. This was a long prove-up. It took more than half an hour, maybe more than an hour, of the trial attorney and the husband being questioned. There was extensive evidence that during the marriage, the wife had wasted or caused the community to incur indebtedness of over $348,000. There were instances where she just changed the names on accounts. There were instances where she pawned property, I guess including my client's golf clubs. She refinanced the mortgage to change it from a 30-year mortgage to a 40-year mortgage, which not only cost them, but there was then the issue of Where was the extra money going? It wasn't going to the mortgage company that was purportedly getting paid. So when you say she got, you know, the husband got everything, well, she had already taken a substantial amount of money from the marital estate. With regard to the punitive damages, as I indicated in my brief, I think they're not just extra damages, they're punitive damages. But if the court decides that he was not entitled to those, I think the court can simply reform the judgment, eliminate the punitive damages award, and let everything proceed. So I want to get to what I think is the real issue here, is the sanctions and what led up to the sanctions. It's an odd situation because there were technically two motions for sanctions, but the motions were really considered three times in total. The first motion for sanctions was actually considered at the temporary orders hearing. And in the temporary orders, the wife is ordered to respond to discovery, make full deposition answers, and provide documents by a specific date. She did not do that. The motion then that had been initially filed was re-urged and reset. There was no new motion. It was the first motion now reset. And the temporary hearing, the trial judge put off any determination of sanctions. He said, I'm giving you a pass. I'm giving you a chance to fix this. Go out and fix it. I'm not going to do anything right now. Just consider it all at final trial. Nothing happened. The husband's attorney re-urged his motion, and in July, we had a second motion for sanctions hearing set, and at that point, we reached an agreement. And in that agreement,
it's in our record, the original temporary orders hearing, the court reporter's record, is that all in our record?
I don't know that there was a court reporter's record from the temporary orders hearing. I think
what the judge said then would not be in the record.
It is reflected in the temporary orders, though. The temporary orders indicate that the wife is ordered to do these things by a certain date, and the court is deferring any decision on sanctions, attorney's fees, and that sort of thing. It's my take on it. The judge is giving you a pass on this. I didn't want to imply that that's exactly what the judge said, but I take that as the judge is giving you a freebie here. See if you can fix it. On July 20th, the wife entered into agreed orders. She's there. She signed the order. Her attorney signed the order. Everybody at that point knows what is expected of them. Again, nothing happens at that point. Subsequently, I believe after the second motion for sanctions was filed, the wife's attorney did deliver a couple of notebooks of just documents. They're not bait stamped. They're not organized by any with reference to any particular request for production. Just here are some documents. Otherwise, the interrogatories, requests for production, are not answered, and the deposition questions are not answered. Husband's attorney files a new motion for sanctions, and that's the one that is set in September. Wife's attorney was notified of, I want to get this straight here, she was notified of the sanctions hearing through the e-filing system. The husband's attorney also sent over a subpoena through the wife's attorney for the wife to appear at the sanctions hearing. And I believe that in the motion for a new trial, which I've cited as reporter's record 4 on page 9, that the wife's attorney concedes that the previous attorney got notice of actually the hearing, this hearing on the sanctions and the hearing on the default judgment. So at least the wife's attorney knew about this. Nobody shows up for the wife's side. No attorney, no client, and the court proceeds with the motion for sanctions. This is really now the third strike. I think that Ms. Palmer has argued that it's somehow our burden to determine whether the fault here was the wife's fault or whether it was her attorney's fault. I would submit to the court that Transamerican does not require that level of proof by us as the movement for motion for sanctions. And in fact, I think it would be, in most cases, virtually impossible. I don't know how I would ever prove whether the wife knew, didn't know, the communication level, who, even if I subpoenaed one of them there, it may be privileged. Our requirement as the husband's attorney is to communicate through the wife's attorney. That was clearly done. And in fact, at the motion for a new trial, there are no witnesses, there's no evidence offered, there's nothing to really substantiate that except the wife's affidavit that was attached to her motion. The court strikes the wife's pleadings. At that point, she has no pleadings on file. She is in the position where a default can be taken against her.
Do you have any case law to support that you can then, when you have a trial setting already in existence that you gave 45 days notice for, that you can then turn around and a week later after the death penalty sanction set it for a default hearing and that that's appropriate? Do you have case law other than the one case that Ms. Parmer made reference to support that that is appropriate under those circumstances when
No.
there was an appearance made?
No. I've not found any case on point that would cover this exact situation. I've had to hit all around it. I cited a couple of cases in my brief, including the Allstate case, which, as Ms. Parmer said, it was, they had filed a motion to quash the citation, so technically they had made an appearance but did not file an answer. And the trial court said, you're free to go ahead, get your default, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that. I have not found anything that would cite, that would address a situation where you've already got one trial setting, but then the pleadings are struck, and now you can go ahead and take your default. I don't have that. I hope it doesn't exist. I hope I haven't overlooked it.
Thank you.
Then the default trial is set. Again, mother's attorney is notified by the e-filing system. I don't believe there was a motion for continuance filed. What I believe happened is there was testimony from husband's attorney that wife's attorney telephoned him the day before the default trial, asked if it could be continued. He said he was not in a position to continue it. And I think that's what the court is referencing. I don't think they actually filed anything. And then again, at the motion for a new trial on page 9 of that record, I believe mother's attorney conceded that the attorney got notice of the default trial setting. Again, nobody shows up. The court goes ahead after a long, lengthy default hearing and grants the judgment that it did. I think the biggest problem in here is how do we as the movement give notice that can be imputed to the wife other than through her attorney? I don't know how I could ever show that the wife didn't get notice. She didn't come in to testify that she didn't get notice. She didn't offer any evidence that she didn't. You know, I can flip the whole thing around at this point and say this is just an instance of a client who was not active in their case for whatever reason, trying to throw their attorney under the bus, blame it all on the attorney who can't really do much about it either at this point, and go forward. So I don't know any other way that we would do that, and that's not what I believe that Transamerican requires. Transamerican, and some of the cases cited in Ms. Parmer's brief, talk about you don't want death penalty sanctions as a first resort except in extreme circumstances. There has to be something really bad to get sanctions as a first resort. And there are some cases where it's happened. Transamerican says you got to show in the record that lesser available sanctions were considered by the court.
Doesn't it have to be in the judgment itself? I mean, isn't there a provision that says that the trial court has to make a finding, not after a request for findings, but actually in the order itself striking the pleadings, that other and lesser sanctions have been imposed and didn't work, basically?
They're not in this order.
That's why I'm asking the question.
However, the record clearly reflects that lesser included sanctions. I guess in the totality of it, not only were they considered, they were considered twice. Actually, they were considered, but the trial court punted, gave a pass on it, and said we're going to put this off. And then there was an agreement to put it off, which the trial judge signed off on. You know, that's a lot of bites at the apple for to basically lose on the, I guess, the idea that it's not in the language of the order verbatim.
Okay, but if it's a requirement, it's a requirement, isn't it?
I think the rule would give guidance as to how the trial court should proceed with it. I don't think at this point that this court is bound by looking just at the sanction rule alone. I think the trial court can look at the other rule, other orders in this case, and determine that this was not appropriate. And I guess, you know, to follow on into the default, once the pleadings had been struck, even if Mother didn't get notice, what would she have done at trial? She doesn't have any pleadings. There's an order that she can't call any witnesses or offer any evidence, essentially.
Examine.
I suppose she could, but I'm not sure how much cross-examination you can make when you can't really call any witnesses or do much else about it. I see that I'm about out of time, and I'm probably at the point where I'm just repeating myself. If there are any other questions or anything I can address, I'll be happy to do so.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Manzer. Ms. Palmer.
Just three brief points. I think that you've hit on the point that I'm trying to make, which is failure to sanction is not a lesser sanction. If the court never sanctioned the client, there can be no finding that a lesser sanction has failed to achieve results. And let me be very clear. Transamerican says the court must give a reasoned explanation. The court must give a reasoned explanation why lesser sanctions would have been ineffective and why the sanction imposed was appropriate. That is not the record must include. That is a specific finding that must be made on the record by the court. And it seems to me when you're presenting an uncontested order to the court, it would be apparent that you would need to include the necessary finding in there. And because I know counsel to be an excellent attorney at trial counsel, what I know is he could not include a lesser sanction because none was ever made. The court never sanctioned my client in any way. In counsel's words, he punted. And to respond to your inquiry as to why it would be important for her to be there, one is obviously cross-examination. The other thing I would point out to this court is that this dissolution included the interests of children. And there is case law from virtually every court of appeals in the state of Texas relating to if one party presents a pleading that says something is in the best interest of the party, the other party, with or without a pleading, is entitled to counter whether or not an activity would be in the best interest of that child. So even if the sanction had been appropriate, which I do not believe it was, my client would have been able to put on contradictory evidence via cross-examination, which may have resulted in a different outcome. So that's all I have, unless you have further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Thank you, Mr. Windsor. We appreciate all of your arguments today, and we also appreciate all your briefing that you've provided us in regard to this case. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We will proceed to case number 2 on our morning docket, Wilder versus Campbell et al.